Just a few notes about listening real quickly. I think the TELUS tape is self-explanatory, but when we get to number 11, which is the tape about minimalism, I'm going to talk about most of these things in class, but let me just give you a few ideas of what you're listening to. Minimalism, which we'll get to towards the end of today, or else next time for sure, is a movement that has sort of confusing definitions about it, which I'll explain when we talk about it. But it really began very much in the 50s with pieces like 4 minutes and 33 seconds of silence. But also this string quartet, this early string quartet of Morton Feldman from 1951, I think is a very clear indication of a certain direction the music is going to take. The next one on the tape is Lamont Young, excerpt from Well-Tuned Piano. The Well-Tuned Piano, what he did is he got a very, very, very good piano, a Bösendorfer, a 9-foot Bösendorfer, and instead of tuning it in tempered tuning, like I explained to you, how everything's just slightly out of tune so that you can play in all keys, well, he had it all tuned to E-flat in natural tuning, so that all the overtones on the piano are related to E-flat. And we just gave you an excerpt. I don't know why Jeff did that tape, and he decided only to give you an excerpt, but the piece itself runs 5.5 hours. We only gave you, what, about 10 minutes of it or something like that, with Lamont playing. Then the next one on is Steve Reich, who we'll be talking about quite a bit next class. He's one of the main people who started the minimal tradition, and this is a piece of his from 1973, and I'll talk about it later, and I'll also talk about the Terry Riley later. So that's listening assignment. Someone said, I think it was Catherine, said that someone in one of her sections said, after last lecture, well, how does this really relate to music? And I think that's a wonderful question. I thought that's how it would start today. One of the things I talked about last time was this notion of, in the 60s, American culture was like a teenager, and it was very much questioning the very limits of ideas that had been presented to them in the 50s. The whole idea of the counterculture was testing the limits of what had been presented before. Now, one of the things that makes limits very clear are definitions. Definitions limit things by the very idea of a definition. So one of the things that's going to be questioned very highly in the 60s are definitions themselves. It's interesting, the Fluxus packet we gave you, I like the way they call it a packet, but anyway, it came from a magazine that was printed in the 60s. This one is actually 1971, called Source Magazine. And it, underneath it says the music of the avant-garde. And actually, ironically enough, every example I'm giving you in this class and last class, except for Andy Warhol, all come out of music journals. Every single piece I talked about are printed in music journals. Now, the editor of this particular journal wrote a preface about why he selected these pieces, and I think it's rather interesting, so I thought I would read it to you. He's talking about the specific pieces in this issue. You, of course, don't have the whole issue. Intermedia, mixed media, happenings, and all other crossings from one art form to another have been an integral part of avant-garde music. Two of the composers in this issue are presenting technological works. Artists are presenting musical works. Time, long the exclusive territory of music, is dealt with by visual artists. The definition of music, which has been stretched to extreme length, finally snapped. And that's a very interesting period. It was a very lively period in the 50s, the 60s, because it seemed like everything was possible. There were no more definitions. I remember when I started writing music, which was around 1966 or so, it was a wonderful kind of revelation because I always felt like I could never write music very well because when I tried to write a fugue in the style of Bach, it was okay, but it certainly wasn't Bach. When I tried to write a sonata in the style of Mozart, you know, I got maybe a B+ or an A-, but it wasn't, you know, an exercise. And it was when I realized, largely from examples like Milton Babbitt and John Cage and the people around me then, that music could be anything I wanted it to be, that there was no definition of right and wrong in music. That's when I started writing music. No one had to listen to it, no one had to like it, no one had to play it, but no one could stop me from writing it. And this is a kind of thing that many composers went through in the 50s and 60s, realizing that for the first time, music could really be their own. Now, when you start questioning definitions, or if you want to change the way the world is, remember the 60s idea was, this is our world and we can change it. But if you want to change the way the world is, when you question definitions, you have to decondition. You have to forget what things meant before you can have a new definition. This is why, for example, in the 60s, LSD became such a popular drug because it just completely destroyed definitions that were so sacred to so many people. And certainly one of the foremost advocates of it was the famous Harvard professor, Timothy Leary. But art was doing the same thing. The motto of LSD was turn on, tune in, and drop out. But couldn't you say the same thing about an art piece? If you go into a concert hall, the sanctuary of art, and the piece confronts your very sensibilities, you're shocked. You don't know what to think about it. And at the same time, you can tune in to your own emotions. You can start thinking about what you really think about this, how it really affects you. And the reason that art is such a sanctuary is that, let's say you're dealing with a piece about violence. When you're on the street and there's violence going on, you're very much physically and emotionally confronted. When you're in the concert hall, you know that you're not going to be injured. Well, you don't know that, but theoretically, I don't think anyone really has been. So you're left with just the thought about what this image is about. You're left with the ability to reevaluate it in your own self and to think about what the issue really means to you. And art as a sanctuary has been that way for quite a long time. It's been a place where things that couldn't happen in any other venue because of their extreme nature could happen in the concert hall and give the artist and the listener a chance of exploring the extremes of what these things were so as to decondition the listener to having expectations and open the possibility for new definitions. Now, last time we talked about how one of the first things that a lot of artists did was simply confront the role of what the audience was compared to the artist. Another issue that they're going to confront rather extremely in the 60s is the idea of danger and violence, because danger and violence was everywhere. People were dying constantly in Vietnam. People were dying in the streets. By 1970, college kids were being shot by the police and killed. Six kids died in 1970. So this issue of violence was around you all the time, and it was something you couldn't ignore. And so consequently, it became one of the issues that came to the concert hall. Tony suggested I read a little bit to you from this book. He was reading it in my office. It just gives you an idea of the kind of atmosphere of despair that was happening in the backstage. But I want to emphasize, in that period, there was a lot of things going on. One of the things was a kind of frustration, a terrible kind of despair. But on another level, there was this kind of wonderful freedom and openness. For the first time, the kids had sort of taken hold of their own lives and thought everything was possible. And so although a lot of the things I'm talking about seem very desperate, there was also this other movement. Remember, they were called the Flower Children, the Love Generation. It was an optimistic kind of thing at the same time. This is not an optimistic book. This was written by Valerie Solanas, who became most famous for having tried to assassinate Andy Warhol in 1970. She unfortunately didn't get very much publicity because she did this 2 days before Robert Kennedy was killed. And the publicity about Robert Kennedy obviously was so much more than what Robert Kennedy was about. Well, of all the feminists who ever lived in the world, I think she's probably the most extreme. She was quite serious about it, too. This is a book of hers called The Scum Manifesto, S-C-U-M, and it stood for Society for Cutting Up Men. There's very little of it I could feel right about reading publicly, but the first paragraph is okay. So I think I'll read you the first paragraph. Life in this society being at best an utter bore, and no aspect of society being at all relevant to women, there reminds to civic-minded, responsible, thrill-seeking females only to overthrow the government, eliminate the money system, institute complete automation, and destroy the male sex. It is now technically possible to reproduce without the aid of males, or, for that matter, females, and to produce only females. We must begin immediately to do so. The male is a biological accident. The Y, or male gene, is an incomplete X female gene. That is, has an incomplete set of chromosomes. In other words, the male is an incomplete female, a walking abortion, aborted at the gene stage. To be male is to be deficient, emotionally blind, limited. Maleness is a deficiency disease, and males are emotional cripples. And after that, I don't think I better read any more to you. Valerie Solanas, S-O-L-O-N-A-S. She was subsequently committed to a hospital for the criminally insane. She was a sadomasochistic prostitute, and her specialty was walking on people with golf shoes. Gives you kind of an idea of her mentality. Well, this notion of danger, as I say, and violence was being explored in many, many ways, both frivolously and seriously. I think a real good example of that is Nam June Paik, who you have some writings of. You have his five symphonies with the third missing in your Flux package. How come it's a packet rather than readings? But anyway, in your Flux package. Nam June did quite a few different pieces, both extremely serious and more frivolous. One of his pieces, which appears again in the music journal, and it's called Danger Music Number 5, reads, "The performer should crawl up the vagina of a living female whale." That's the piece. It hasn't been done yet. Nam June was born in 1932 in Korea, but spent most of his artistic days really in the United States, and lives sort of between New York and Germany at this stage. And in 1961, he founded an institute, which I don't think many people belong to, called the University of Avant-Garde Hinduism. Well, Nam June also, just to give you a little bit of background, he invented the video synthesizer and made quite a bit of money. A lot of the things you see on TV as special effects were his invention. And mostly what he does now is video art. And often you'll be in an art gallery and you'll see his installations. They're usually like a whole bunch of video monitors showing various things at various times. But he called himself a composer then. Now I don't know if he does. I haven't seen him in quite a few years. But another piece he did, which was a very serious piece, is he came onto stage. I saw this one. He came onto the stage and he took a razor blade and he cut an 8-centimeter cut in his arm and you watched it bleed. That was the piece. Again, the kind of thing, you know you're not going to get hurt and you've seen blood on the street, but now you're sitting in a concert hall looking at someone bleeding. Very, very much a kind of deconditioning thing of what is violence about? How can this person do this? Another piece that was a very elegant piece that he did, not nearly so dangerous, was he stretched a canvas across the entire stage, big white canvas. Then he came out and took off his shirt, which he usually did when he performed, and then he very meticulously shaved his head. Then he brought out a bucket of red paint, and he dipped his head in the paint, and very slowly drew a line across the canvas with his head, so that there was a red line going across the stage, and that was the piece. He certainly was one of the more visible of the Fluxus artists, and we'll be coming back to him on various levels. There was another artist by the name of Ayo, A-Y-O, who's also in your packet. I saw a piece of his at the Albright Knox Gallery in New York, in Buffalo. I don't think a lot of these things people would get away with anymore, but this piece, I'm sure, wouldn't be legal anymore. It was a set of very beautifully made boxes, and you couldn't see in the inside, but you were allowed to put your hand in. And in some of them, there were just wonderful things you could feel, you know, sort of velvety, and all sorts of different textures, but in some of them were razor blades and broken glass. And you didn't know when you stuck your hand in a box, if you chose, because there was a note telling you this, but you didn't know if you chose to stick your hand in the box, whether what it would come out looking like, in other words. This was Ayo. One of the pieces you have in your readings was by a guy by the name of Kosugi, Japanese, born in 1938, who also spent most of his time in this country. He's this very gentle guy who actually is one of the performers with the Merce Cunningham Company. He does the music for them. But in those days, he wrote this rather disgusting piece, which is in your readings, called Music for a Revolution, which simply reads, "Scoop out one of your eyes 5 years from now and do the same with the other 5 years later." Interesting. Another artist who actually, his name was Wolfgang Stercke. He died in the 70s. A lot of these people did die in the 70s. It was a very intense time to live through. He performed with a music group called the California Time Machine, and it was billed again as music performances. And one of his more famous pieces was he built, it took him several months, his beautiful thick wall out of plastic. Really nice wall, you know, bigger than this blackboard and higher. And he supported it very well. And Wolfgang almost always performed naked. He came out and he had a big pulley attached to a rope. And he swung on the pulley and smashed himself into this wall until the wall broke. And that was part of a musical piece, is one of their concerts. There was also, well, a good example of all this is Source 6. This came out in about 66, 67. I'm sure you can't see it very well, but the cover has a machine gun on it with all sorts of score paper shot up. And the first piece in it that you open up is a piece of score paper with bullet holes in it. And it's an excerpt from a Dick Higgins piece called 1,000 Symphonies. And Dick Higgins went to a police shooting range and put up all sorts of music paper and then blasted it with machine guns. And wherever the bullet holes came were the pitches that would be played. That's the title of last week's, the other class, A Thousand Symphonies. So he wrote A Thousand Symphonies this way. And if you bought all of the source issues printed that year, number six, you would get one of the symphonies. So that each one is unique. No other source issue except this Harvard one has this particular page. Now, if you turn the page, you get another piece by someone, well, here's the documentation, but you get a piece by Philip Horner, who's also actually always been a composer, teaches composition in New York. This piece is very simple. It simply reads, one anti-personnel type CBU bomb will be thrown into the audience. This is a very intense issue. These are all in the library if you want to look at them. Then if you keep going in Source 6, you get to a piece by Daniel Lentz called Hydro Geneva Emergency Piece Number 3, which is dedicated to the children dying in Vietnam. It's a, have you ever used that ear medicine that dissolves earwax? It's basically hydrogen peroxide. If you put hydrogen peroxide in your ear, you will hear the sound of your earwax melting, and it sort of crackles, sort of like burning fire. Well, that piece is Dan Lentz would go around the audience and put the hydrogen peroxide in everyone's ears and then ask them to think about the children dying in Vietnam. This was not a very positive issue, as you can tell. It was sort of at the peak of when things were going badly. Getting off the danger subject, another thing composers were going to explore in different ways was the whole concept of failure. Because part of the problem with the counterculture was, in a sense, the culture, the main culture, defined it as a failure. Everything they were doing was a failure. So people were going to write pieces directly about failure. Most of these were gentler. There's a piece by Lamont Young called Piano Piece for David Tudor No. 2. Open the keyboard cover without making, from the operation, any sound that is audible to you. That's almost completely impossible because it's a very large thing to open and there are hinges and it's just about impossible to do that. Try as many times as you like. The piece is over either when you succeed or when you decide to stop trying. It is not necessary to explain to the audience. Simply do what you do and when the piece is over, indicate it in a customary way. So in a concert, you'd walk into the concert hall and someone would come out, you know, take a bow and then try to open the piano lid for any length of time that he decided not making a sound, and then when he's done, he'll turn around and bow, and that would be the piece. There's another piece by Harold Budd, who we'll be talking about later on, a thing called Lovely Thing for Piano. This is also in Source 6. First of all, it starts with an inexplicable quote by another composer named Barney Childs that has nothing to do with the piece. The quote is, about all one can do is trickle hot alcoholic beverages over the afflicted area. Now, the piece reads, select a chord of your own choosing or someone else's. If in doubt, call me at 213-662-7819 for spiritual advice. Play this chord as quietly as possible. If some of the notes don't sound, wait until the sounds you have made have completely vanished, then try again. If you get it the first time, wait for the sounds to vanish, then try again, but softer, and so on, and so on. Another very popular kind of a confrontation in the concert hall was something I talked about a little before, the whole notion of the instrument being the sort of grand representation of the European tradition, almost a sacred object in a concert hall. Almost, if we're talking about art as a sanctuary, the piano is sort of the Bible of the sanctuary. So that starts getting questioned in a lot of ways, too. The earliest that I can think about, at least in this period, where people did this was Jerry Lee Lewis in the 50s, who was a rock and roll singer, one of the very first ones. And he had a very big tune called Great Balls of Fire. And occasionally when he would perform the tune, he'd be sitting there wildly playing, and then he'd pour a lot of kerosene on the piano, throw in a match, and keep playing the piece until the piano got literally too hot to play. This happened quite a bit in rock and roll in the 60s as well. But this was starting to happen very much in the people around the Fluxus movement. There's a very interesting composer who we're going to come back to quite a bit now by the name of John Cale. Many of you probably know about him from popular music. He's still around, sort of obscure, but around. Well, John Kell was originally Welsh, and he was classically trained in composition. And he went to a summer festival called Tanglewood, which is in the Berkshire Mountains here, and is like the major festival in the United States. And to be a composition student at Tanglewood is very, very difficult to get in. They only accept a very few, and the few that they accept are exceptionally well qualified. John Cale, in fact, was the one there that was the most honored that year because he got the Leonard Bernstein Fellowship in composition, which was the highest honor you could get. Well, little did they know what they were getting when they asked him if they could perform a piece of his, because since he was such an honored student, they felt they should perform a piece of his. Now, I know this story because a friend of mine was there this year. I've never read this anywhere, but a very, very dear friend of mine was there. This is 1963. The first piece he proposed to the composition faculty was to gather the pianos up at Tanglewood, attach them to helicopters, and drop them in the main field. They rejected that piece. The second piece he proposed was to take two pianos and put them back to back and have half of the most famous people at Tanglewood, they have the Boston Symphony and very famous people there, stand at one piano and the other half stand at the other piano and push them together and see who wins. They rejected that piece. They finally let him do a performance because they had to, because he was the Leonard Bernstein Fellow, and the performance they finally let him do, my friend came out and started playing a very pretty passage on the piano. Next to the piano was a dresser, and John Cale came out with an axe, a double-edged axe, and just completely destroyed the dresser while my friend played very pretty things on the piano. And this continued, obviously, for, I think he said it took almost a half hour by the time the dresser was destroyed. Or some of the, George McCunis, who I told you last week was one of the who founded the word Fluxus, he wrote a piece called Solo for Violin. Old classic is performed on the violin. Where pauses are called, violin is mistreated by scratching it on the floor, dropping pebbles through the F-hole, that's the little hole in the violin, and pulling the pegs out. He also wrote a piece where the performer comes into the piano with a hammer and nails and meticulously nails down all the keys on the piano. I was going to do that for you today, but I decided not to. It takes too long. And obviously you find in the 60s, the same thing obviously happening in rock and roll. I'm sure you all see pictures of Jimi Hendrix burning his guitar in concert. He liked to do that. Or Keith Moon, the drummer with The Who, liked to do sort of extreme things. And once when he was on the Johnny Carson show, he blew up his drum set. He was hospitalized, in fact. It was such a big explosion. Poor Johnny Carson, between Andy Warhol and Keith Moon, I mean, he's really, really been through it. He should write just about like the strange things that happened on his show over the years. Well, obviously, in this generation that was also called the free love generation, a lot of the pieces were going to confront one's attitudes about sex. Just as a footnote, one of the ironies about things that happen in history, one of the main reasons that this whole generation came about in certain ways was because of the birth control pill. The birth control pill completely revolutionized the attitude toward sex because it made it a very different, much more accessible kind of thing. But this confrontation of sex again goes way back, as do almost all of the things we're talking about. And you can see it happening even in pre-Dada. There was a person we talked about earlier called Frank Wedekind. His actual name was Benjamin Franklin Wedekind. And he was a very, very, very extreme artist. And as early as 1901, he was doing things on stage which are more obscene than anything I've ever seen in the Fluxus movement or anything like that. He was very often arrested after concerts, and he wrote a series of plays that almost never were performed more than once because the police came and shut them down. He was known as the anti-bourgeois exploiter of sexuality. Now, he took on a kind of role, which we're going to talk about later, a little bit like Alfred Jarry before, of the artist as the mad outsider. The artist is somewhere that no longer needs to conform to social values because the concert hall becomes the sanctuary for this person, yes. Wedekind, V-E-D-E-K-I-N-D, I believe. Frank. And that, he was also one of the main founders of the Dada movement later on, and one of the people who performed with them a lot. But this was all the way back in 1901 when he was first arrested. You're going to start seeing more and more of this kind of confrontation of the artist being the mad outsider. outsider, and we'll come back to that again later, too. Some of the other pieces that were confronting the audiences was one was a film made by Yoko Ono and John Lennon, which is a half-hour film only of people behind for the entire half hour. Another piece, which was a very extreme one in 1970, I think it was, Wolfgang Stirkler, the one who ran into the plaster. Well, he did a piece at the Newport Art Museum in California, which is a very chichi art museum, you know, and very rich people go to see performances, and this was billed as a music performance. Well, Wolfgang came on the stage naked. This is a four-hour piece. Stood completely still without moving and tried his damnedest for 4 hours to remain sexually stimulated. And that's what you saw for 4 hours, with Wolfgang absolutely motionless. And actually, most of the people stayed, he said, which was interesting. Namjoon wrote a very interesting piece that I won't go into all the details again. It was called A Panty Piece for Alison Knowles. And the performer comes out, it's a woman with a loose skirt on, and under her skirt she has like, I forgot how many, it's like 20 pairs of panties. And he gives her all these instructions, like she nails one to the wall and she puts one on a music stand. And the piece finally ends with her putting the last pair in the critic's mouth. This was performed actually quite a few times. I don't think the critics liked that one. He also was the first person arrested that I know of in the 60s for his opera called Opera Sextronique, where Charlotte Moorman, who's this very wonderful, strange cellist, was bare-breasted, and that was illegal. She did all sorts of pieces. There's some that are listed in your reading. She did these pieces like where she would put her cello in a solid block of ice, and then the piece was bowing it until she got down to the cello. She also performed underwater several times. There's basically no piece that she wouldn't do. She did this other piece with Namjoon once, where Namjoon takes off his shirt and takes a violin string and puts it behind his back, and she bows him using his spinal, his spine for the different notes that she plays. That one I did see. As I say, the 60s were very extreme. One of the extreme things lately that's come up is Karen Finley, who's one of the people that the National Endowment for the Arts has had trouble with because they feel that what she's doing is obscene and the presenters that are presenting her shouldn't be funded. Basically, what she's been doing is smearing chocolate all over her naked body in order to protest the kind of what she feels the excrement society is putting on women, and how even though women are supposed to be equal, they really are not. Well, back in 1963, again, it was more extreme, and a woman by the name of Carolee Schneeman did a piece which was called Meat Joy, M-E-A-T, and she called it a flesh celebration relating to Artaud, McClure, and French butcher shops. In this piece, there were a bunch of people naked on the floor rolling in carcasses of dead beef covered with blood. This was her statement about feminism. A rather stronger one, I think, than Karen Finley, but again, I think representative of what was going on much more in the 60s. Okay, well, the extreme of all of this, I think, not the extreme in terms of violence or anything, but the extreme artistic stance of all of this was something called conceptual art or concept art. It was a art form that arose both in visual art and music and pretty much everything. The term was coined in 1963 by Henry Flint, who also is in your reading, so I won't worry about writing him down. Well, concept art was about the notion of, it was such an extreme of art, it was art that could never be done. It was art that only could be imagined. It was never intended to be done. It was only existed in the artist's mind. And what more confrontation is there than art that doesn't even exist? I mean, it's sort of the extreme that you can take this whole notion to. Some of the pieces that happened. Lamont Young was, again, one of the main people that was influential in this movement. By the way, Brian Eno, who most of you know, probably from the pop world, who invented ambient music and has been a very important figure in popular music for a long time, called Lamont Young, quote, the granddaddy of us all. So you can see another crossover into popular music. Lamont Young's going to have a very important role in popular music later on. Well, Composition 15, 1960, reads, this piece is little whirlpools out in the middle of the ocean. That's the piece. It's interesting because it's dedicated to a guy by the name of Richard Hoyltsenbeck, who I mentioned what seems like very many months ago when I was talking about Dada. Remember when I told you about when Dada was founded, Hugo Ball and this guy were sitting in a room and everyone had left the club, and Hugo Ball said, da-da, and that was the beginning of the movement. Well, he was the guy who wrote that down. And he was the guy who moved to New York and changed his name and became a famous psychoanalyst. Well, this piece is dedicated to him. So it shows you very clearly that Lamont Young knew very, very well the Dada tradition if he's going to dedicate a piece to one of the founders of Dada. Another piece of Lamont Young, piano piece for David Tudor, number 3. Most of them were very old grasshoppers. That's the piece. There's some very nice pieces. Remember the guy with the anti-personnel bomb? Well, he wrote some very nice pieces, again, for a music journal. I'll read a few of them to you. They're short. This one's called Sweat Composition for San Francisco. Take 27 friends to the top of Twin Peaks and wait until the fog comes in. As it does, moving over the peaks and then down from the Castro area to the Mission, have everyone spray deodorant into the fog. Each person should spray at least 39 cans into the fog. Watch the city dry up. Another one, Composition for a Nightmare, number 1. Plan to have your complete neighborhood take a day to prepare this composition. You will need everyone available. At a given time of day, everyone waits for a signal to open all of the windows in their homes, and from the windows will pelt a lonely auto coming down the street. From every direction, people start throwing large orange coffee mugs at the car. Hundreds of mugs are thrown by many people. The driver of the car should begin to go insane and probably say, quote, "There are hundreds of people throwing orange coffee mugs at me from their windows." Keep throwing coffee mugs at the auto until it melts into the gutter. Then one last piece from him, Ecology Composition. By the way, this was the beginning of ecology in the 60s. That was the first time, because we had gone to the moon and in space, that we actually saw the Earth from outer space. And although that's not singularly responsible by any means for the ecology movement, it certainly wasn't such a strong visual image to actually see the whole Earth from outer space. And it made people, and I think the first Earth Day was in the late 60s when people were beginning finally to realize that we had to be responsible to our environment. Well, this was his answer to that. Cut down a tree, then cut down a shrub, cut down 2 rows of hedges, cut down plants and vines, cut down flowers and food. Take your axe and cut it into 3 pieces. Over one piece, you place a slice of bacon. The second, an ice cube wrapped in bacon. The third, a small jar of orange marmalade topped with slices of bacon. Bring your friends to this scene of destruction and tell them all about the orange marmalade. Tell them whatever you think is important about them. Try to make them laugh. If they do not laugh, you might start making statements like, quote, "You see that tree? I cut it down in 1.5 minutes." Or, quote, "There aren't too many things I like better than cutting down hedges." If they don't laugh by then, when everything inside has been devastated, suggest that they leave quietly, perhaps on their toes. Robert Moran. There were also pieces done in those days that really were called musical pieces. I'm sure you can't see it from up here, but these are just squiggles in line on a piece of paper with absolutely no instructions. It's a piece by Terry Riley, who will come back to this quite a bit, and it's called Concert for 2 Pianists and Tape Recorders, and that's the piece. So again, it's a conceptual piece. Nothing can be done with it. You could take something and make a realization out of it if you wanted to, but it wasn't really thought of that way. It's really thought of simply as, this is what it is. Now again, these images are singular, non-dialectic images. They're simply images that exist that make it possible for the viewer, in this case, or if you want to call it listener, to confront their feelings about that particular image, whether it's a violent image or a funny image or simply an image which is in your mind. It still is a non-dialectic idea, and it still comes from the notion of Cage that if you're going to be open to changing meaning, and if you're going to decondition the way you think about things, then you have to eliminate duality, because duality creates the dialectic. Dialectic creates reasoning and thinking, and therefore words are once again tied up with their old meaning. I think, however, one of the real essences of the difference between Cage and the next generation is stated by Cage in Source 6, actually. And again, I say that the 50s were a cultural revolution, the 60s really a social and political revolution. Well, in Source 6, there's a whole series of composers, they ask the same question, and they all reply with a brief answer. The question is, have you used your music for political or social ends? Cage's answer. I am interested in social ends, but not in political ends, because politics deal with power, and society deals with numbers of individuals. And I'm interested both in single individuals and large numbers or medium numbers or any kind of numbers of individuals. In other words, I'm interested in society not for purposes of power, but for purposes of cooperation and enjoyment. And it's quite a change from the confrontational art of the 60s in the aspect it took on when it becomes a social and political confrontation. One of the movements that's going to come out of all of this, which is going to linger and still exist, is a movement which is called minimalism. And the definition of minimalism has changed drastically over the years and has become, in my mind, very confused. Originally, minimalism applied to kinds of pieces which you might expect that had very little going on in them. And remember this notion I talked about as specks in the wall? Well, composers are starting to deal with this notion of looking at something very up close, very, very detailed way, non-dialectic still, things that would go on for long times in an unchanging way. Obviously, again, we have the roots of this in the 50s. The obvious root of it is 4 minutes and 33 seconds of silence. What could be more minimal than that? I mean, could you do less than do nothing? The structures for string quartet of Morty Feldman, you'll find, uses very, very little material in it. It's a very delicate piece. It's about a 7-minute piece, and it has all sorts of repetition in it. There's certain passages that just repeat over and over and over. And I remember Morty thought it was very funny because when the record first came out, quite a few copies were returned because they thought there was a scratch on the record and it was skipping, and that's why it repeated so many times. It never occurred to them that he actually composed that many repetitions. Christian Wolff, the other one we talked about in the New York School, was writing very, very minimal music. Like he has this duet for two violins that goes on for over 10 minutes, and it's only three notes, E and E flat, right next to each other, just played in different ways, over and over, just three notes for 10 minutes, very, very minimal. But as you'd expect, I think the 60s, like everything else, took minimal music to a level that was not thought of before. A good extreme example, like always, is Andy Warhol. He did two movies in the early 60s. He became quite famous. They're not shown very much anymore, nor are they available in video stores for reasons that will be obvious. The first movie he made was one called Sleep. And Sleep is a movie of a person sleeping for 8 hours. It's an 8-hour film, one person on a bed. I saw the person interviewed later on TV, and he said actually they had to cheat a little in the movie because he woke up after 6 hours, so they actually spliced in 2 hours of previous material of him sleeping. The second movie Andy Warhol made was one called Empire. And Empire was a shot of... It was a movie camera on a tripod focused on the Empire State Building, again for 8 hours. He turned it on in the morning, and 8 hours later he came back and turned it off. So obviously what could be more minimal in the concept of film than those particular pieces? There was another minimal piece done by Steve Reich, who we'll talk more and more about also, where he put two speakers lying flat on the stage facing up. And above these speakers on pulleys, he suspended microphones. Now, I won't demonstrate this, but if I were to put my microphone directly in front of the speaker, you get a horrible sound, which we refer to as feedback. This sort of almost sounds like a scream. Well, this piece of Steve's, what you do is you take these microphones and you go way high on ladders and you just simply swing them over the speakers. So every time they cross the speakers, they're going to make this horrible sound and gradually they're going to stop and the whole thing is just going to end with feedback. Terry Riley did the opposite version of it. He suspended two microphones on the stage and hung speakers, and he threw them across. Or another Fluxus piece, which I think is in your kit, called Anima 7 by Kusugi. Perform any action as slowly as possible. So performers sometimes would perform that by simply coming out on the stage and walking to the piano absolutely as slowly as they could. Some of these performances obviously would take extremely long. But once again, the sort of guru of them all was Lamont Young in many ways, who started dealing with extremely long sounds. I'm going to play an excerpt from a piece of his called Drift Studies. One of the things that happens if you have a synthesizer, let's say, producing a tone, and you have one almost in the same intonation, but just slightly off from that, not quite on the same pitch, is that you'll get what they call beating, sort of, it's because of a phasing principle that happens in it. Well, this piece is simply that. One of the nice things about technology in 1960 is it wasn't very good. So if you took two oscillators that generate noise and tried to tune them exactly to the same pitch, over a period of time, they're going to drift apart slightly. A lot of composers found this very frustrating at the time, but not Lamont. He did, this is, as I say, an excerpt from a very long piece called Drift Studies, where simply he's letting them go out of tune with each other. Let me play just a short excerpt. I won't play the whole thing. It was also a period when quite a few composers were doing what they would call sound environments, where they would set up just a single sound in a room, and you could come into the room as long as you wanted to and listen to it. And actually, this became quite fashionable in the 70s, and quite a few very rich people would employ these artists to come to their house and design a sound environment for a particular room in the house. I don't think Lamont ever did that, but quite a few of the rest of them did. Well, Lamont wrote another piece in 1960 called Composition No. 7, 1960, where he just gives you two notes, and he says, to be held for a very long time. Well, 1963, when the piece was premiered, they held it for 5 hours, those two notes. And this piece, like Drift Studies, is part of a long piece of Lamont Young's called The Tortoise, His Dreams, and His Journeys. Lamont Young, as you might expect, really likes turtles and tortoises. He got his pet tortoise 49, he called it 49, back. His pieces are sections of this about a tortoise. Another piece he did with his band, and his band was called, by the way, the Theater of Eternal Music. Another piece he did with them is they listened, he had sea turtles for a while, and he really loved the, remember, he loved the sound of motors. Well, they all went and listened to the sound of his aquarium motor for a very, very long time and found out how to duplicate it exactly, and that was what they performed. Now, what was interesting about the Theater of Eternal Music is that I don't remember too many times previously in history when a composer actually had a band. This was kind of a new idea for a composer to have a band. Now, in this band were several interesting figures, too. One of them was John Cale, who's going to become one of the founding members of the Velvet Underground. And another member in the band who's going to become a very, very, very important figure in minimal music was someone named Terry Riley. And this is going to start happening with quite a few composers as a way of coming up with a new kind of music that couldn't really be done in a concert hall and really needed the kind of dedication of certain people working on it for a long time. I mean, you couldn't write a piece for two pitches that's supposed to last 5 hours and expect the New York Philharmonic to play it. So consequently, this notion of a band starts interpenetrating, and what you're going to start seeing is certain concepts of the bands that are happening in popular music and in classical music. How can you call it classical music? Where in this music, whatever it is, are going to start sharing certain aspects, especially with people like John Cale, who does with the Velvet Underground many of the things that he had done earlier with Lamont Young. And more and more and more, as we'll see in the next class and as we move into other kinds of minimalism, more and more and more, because we're dealing with lack of definitions now, we're questioning of definitions, because there's so few definitions, what is this music? What is popular music? What popular music is in rock and roll at that stage is very questionable. It's not like rock and roll that we know now at all, and it's really a very, very different kind of music. And what made it popular was its relationship, in both cases, to the counterculture, representing a kind of new way of reevaluating the world at this stage. And it very much is a symbol of a revolution, not a music in the pure sense of the word. So next time we'll start with the Velvet Underground and move from there into the rest of the minimal tradition. Have a good weekend.